Good morning. How's everyone doing? Doing all right? Well, the title of my talk today is Learning to Work. And I think I'm probably going to do two talks about work. The next one, unless some other topic intervenes, sometimes that happens, something just comes up. But I think it's going to be about how opportunities to serve others, opportunities to take on jobs can be a very important, very useful part of our practice. That in a community like this, taking on a job of some kind is not just giving back to the community, but there's more to it. It can be really a very profound form of practice. There's something about taking on something that maybe you're not too sure about, and being willing to follow through with that no matter what happens, that can maybe challenge you in kind of a deep way, kind of challenge the way you normally go about things, and bring you to something a little more open. When I talk about that, it's not going to be based just on my desire to get jobs here at Zen Center filled, although I think that's a wonderful thing. It's going to be really my wish to share with you the forms of practice that have made a profound difference in my life. And I find that taking on certain jobs for me has really changed me. And I'm going to do that today, too. I'm going to try to share some things with you that have made a really profound difference in my practice, hoping that it'll have some meaning for you. Today, I'm going to tell you some stories. So just settle in. I'm going to tell you some stories about when I was young, my childhood, and when I was a young adult, and they have to do with work. I think learning to work is a very big part of our lives. It doesn't just happen that we know how to work. It takes place over a long period of time, and we keep learning how to work our entire lives. We get a lot of tough lessons. We learn about attachment and control, and we learn about giving up control, and we learn about how, ironically, somehow giving up control gives us a measure of peace. Even though we think every step of the way that's not true, we got to be in control. We give up control, and wow, it's okay. I didn't have to control all that stuff. I couldn't control all that stuff. That was impossible. So I have left the realm of impossibility for the realm of what is. So we learn how to work, and I think ultimately we kind of unlearn how to work. So this begins with my childhood. I grew up in North Dakota, southeastern North Dakota, in the southern Red River Valley, that great empty expanse, that beautiful empty expanse, about 6 miles from the Minnesota border, 6 miles from the Red River, the one that floods all the time. And so this is about working, and it's mostly about working for money. And money was on my mind some as a child, not a lot, but it was kind of on my mind because we didn't have any. We lived on a farm, and some farmers do very well, but we really struggled, and there was never any extra money. So I'd always be thinking about, well, how can I make some money? You know, what can I do? I remember my parents one time signed me and my two brothers up for a credit union, and they gave us this little folder to save dimes in. You put a little dime in, and maybe after you get about 40 dimes in there, you've got $4, you take it to the credit union and you deposit it. I remember getting that card and having it for a year, maybe 2 years, and never filling it up. That's how tight that stuff. Those dimes weren't there. Of course, this was a long time ago when a dime was worth a little more than it is now. But and that's cool. I'm not complaining about this. You know, I'm really happy with the way I grew up. I think I was actually an incredibly lucky person. I had a loving family, and it was really stable, and I had this beautiful farm to have adventures on, and it was great. And next to that stuff, you know, money is pretty small consideration. But kids, you know, and kids have this kind of entrepreneurial spirit anyway, right? It's like you get this idea, oh, I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to have a lemonade stand or something. I'm going to make some money, and it's going to be really a lot of fun. So when I was maybe pretty little, I was maybe 8 or something like that. I think it was my first project to make some money. And I got this magazine called Boy's Life in connection with scouting. And this magazine would have these ads which were meant to appeal to that entrepreneurial spirit. Like, you do our thing, you sell our product, and you get to win a prize or you keep something for yourself. And one of these things that they did was greeting cards. They send you greeting cards, you sell them door to door, you send the money into the company, and you get a prize or you get to keep some money. And I really wanted to do this. That sounded so cool. And I asked my mom, and she said no. She said no every time. And I think it's because she was really kind of fiercely independent, you know. And even though we didn't have much money, we wouldn't ever take a handout from anyone. And she would not want people to buy something from me just because they felt sorry for me or something like that. You know, I think that's where she was coming from. And she kept saying no every time. And then I got this issue, and it had something a little different. It was the same kind of ad for selling greeting cards, but it had a baseball theme. And I love baseball, as some of you know. And I remember it clearly now, pretty clearly. It was this two-page spread in the magazine, and I remember the green of the outfield and the tan of the base paths and all the prizes arrayed over this thing, right, that you could get. And that was pretty cool. And here's the kicker. This thing was sponsored by Mickey Mantle of the New York Yankees, number 7, who was my personal hero. This guy was my hero. Because in 1961, when I was 7 years old, the year Roger Maris hit 61 home runs, Mickey Mantle hit 54. I was pretty impressionable. The Yankees have been my favorite team ever since. I get a lot of flack for that. Be gentle here. But he was great. He was the most powerful guy in baseball, probably, and he was fast. He could bunt, he could steal. He was one of the fastest guys in baseball. Incredible combination. Won the Triple Crown in 1956. And he was this guy from Oklahoma. He had this big smile, and he looked like a big kid, you know. And I identified with him, and I wanted to be like him. And I thought, you know, I'm going to be a Major League Baseball player. That's my career choice. A lot of kids think that, you know. And it didn't matter that I was one of the smallest kids in school, literally, and that I really didn't have any strength or any coordination, and I couldn't hit the ball very far, and I couldn't really field. That was okay. That stuff would all work itself out. It's kind of like I used to live in this house. We had 3 dogs, and one of the dogs was named Sydney, and he was a schnauzer, and he weighed about 12 pounds. And one of the dogs was named Genghis Khan, and he was a husky, and he weighed about 50 pounds. And you couldn't put them together, because every time they got together in the same room, Sydney would attack Genghis, just with great viciousness, even though he outweighed him 4-1. Because dogs don't know how big they are. And I was kind of the same way. So this is my career path, you know, it's my way out of here. This is a big deal. So free enterprise, my hero, a way out of here, all this stuff is coming together. I begged my mom. Oh, and here's the real kicker. If you did this thing, they would send you a picture of Mickey Mantle. And I really wanted that. You know, I couldn't afford to buy something like that. And I could put it on my wall. I was so excited about that. So I begged my mom. I just begged her. And she gave in, finally. She saw how important it was. So we did the thing. And my brother Jim and I, he's 2 years older than me, we went to Dwight, the nearest town, population 101. And we sold all of these cards. And some people were like, you're doing what? You know, and other people were really helpful, really friendly, and it was kind of fun. It was kind of weird. I didn't have many social or, you know, sales skills when I was 8. But we sold all of this stuff, and I elected to get the money rather than the prize. And I think I made $3, which was quite a lot. So I sent in the money we had collected, and I was excited about my picture. And one day, in kind of happy anticipation, I was going through the materials again, thinking about, oh, I'm going to get this thing, you know. And I found this little card, and this card said, you must include this card in your envelope to get your picture. Yeah, and oh no. And you know, it didn't occur to me to like write them a letter and say, oh, I forgot to put the card in, can you please send me the picture? They probably would have done that. It didn't occur to me to ask my folks, what do I do about this situation? I just thought, oh, I'm not getting it, you know. And I was a bit crushed and a little bit disappointed. And I think I learned something there. That was one of my first lessons, right? This is my first entrepreneurial project, and I learned a lesson, which is you can get burned. You have to be really careful. You have to really watch what you do. You can't always expect the best case scenario. This is a hard lesson that we all learn. So that was one thing I did. My first really big enterprise, when I was maybe 12 or so, was raising chickens, because we had had a lot of chickens on this farm. We had had at one point 1,500 in our barn, and we quit raising chickens because we weren't making any money. But we still had all of the equipment, and we had our two chicken houses, which were two little buildings smaller than this Zendo, more like the size of the Founders Hall over there. And we had a granary full of oats that you could feed to them. We had all the equipment. We had everything we needed. And so my folks said I could get my own chickens and I could raise them, and they would buy them from me when they were grown at the market price, you know, for meat, and a neighbor would buy some as well. And I thought that was pretty good. So I got 100 Cornish Rock chicks in the spring. Little fuzzy things, they're like 2 days old, and they peep, and they're the cutest little things, you know, just little bit beginnings of feathers on their wings, and the rest is fuzz. And in the chicken house, I had a cardboard circle you put them in, and there was a little feeder and a little waterer, and you care for them, you know. You have to go out there several times a day in the beginning, check on them all the time. And then when they get a little bigger, you remove the cardboard thing, and you bring in bigger feeders and things, and you don't have to check on them quite as often, maybe two or three times a day, and you do those chores. And I felt really good about that. I was taking responsibility. I was capable. You know, I was doing this thing. And there was this outdoor run, so it was kind of a cage outside, so they could come out of the chicken house outside and pick up bugs and worms and eat them. And to get out there, there's this little door they go through. There's a little hook and eye in there. So you lift up the little door, right, and you fasten the hook and eye, because you let them out in the morning and you put them in the evening, because a fox or something might get in there if you leave that open during the night. And there was something a little bit wrong with this door, and sometimes it would slip down, and I had to go out and check it. And this really hot day came. It was really hot. It can get so hot up there in North Dakota, you know, over 90 degrees and really humid. And I can remember my mom saying, you have to go out to the chicken house and you have to check that door, because if you don't, you know, you're going to be in trouble. Those chickens are going to be in trouble. And I didn't want to do it. It was so hot, you know. And I was pretty lazy as a kid. And I'm not in this talk holding myself up as kind of a paragon of virtue, you know, someone who really works all the time. I was lazy as a kid, and I was pretty lazy as a young person, young man, too. I'm gaining on it now. So I didn't go, and she told me about three times I didn't go, and I went out in the evening, and this still pains me after all these years. I'm still ashamed of myself. The door had fallen down, and four chickens had been caught outside, and they died out there in the heat, and that was a terrible death, and it was my fault. It was totally my fault. No excuse whatsoever, and I really learned something there about working. Sometimes you just have to do it, right? You just have to do it. There is no excuse. There's no getting out of it. You just have to forget your own needs and you go do the thing. And we all learned this too. And my mom didn't say anything more, as I recall. She knew I had learned this through my own actions. You know, it's my own karma. She doesn't need to reinforce it. It was a strong lesson. And it was kind of a little jolt into adulthood, I think. And I can remember a couple of much more positive experiences. There was another one when I was older, maybe, 12 or 13. There's lots of work to do on the farm, you know, and you don't get paid for it. You're just expected to help out. When we had chickens, I'd feed and water the chickens every day and gather the eggs, and there'd be seasonal stuff like cleaning out the manure and helping with the harvest and that kind of thing. And sometimes the whole family would be working on a project together, and those are actually some of my happiest memories. Those were some really nice days. And we had a day like that where we were working out in a field. It was a field of soybeans. And the problem was there were cockleburrs there. Some of you probably know what cockleburrs are. It's a weed. And they get really big, and they have these really stiff stalks, and they get these burrs on them. So if you walk past them, you get the burrs all in your clothes. And that was not the problem. The problem is they would get so big that when harvest time came, they would choke up the combine. And my dad would have to stop every once in a while and pull all these cockleburrs out of the combine. He'd never get the field harvested. So we had to go out there and pull these things by hand, you know. And they were pretty big. And one day, my whole family went out there. There were five of us at that time. Later it was six, but there were five of us then. And we started in the morning, and we worked for maybe 2 or 3 hours. And then we went in for a snack. And somebody stayed behind that then and did something else. And then we went back out to the field, four of us. And then we had lunch. And after lunch, somebody else took a break. And even my dad took a break and did something else at one point during that day. So everybody got a break for a couple hours during that day, except me. I did not take a break. And nobody noticed this. And I really enjoyed my work that day. And I just felt really good. And I thought, I'm not going to tell anybody. I'm just going to be happy that I put in a good 8-hour day. I worked as hard as anyone else. I'm not taking credit for it. So I never did, until now. And I think, you know, I kind of felt like, it's funny, I remember that day so clearly, right? Because it's not a big deal. It's sort of a day working in the fields. But I feel kind of like I learned to work that day, that I learned that there's this kind of joy in work, that it feels good to do it. And you just keep at it. You just keep at it. You go through a lot of changes in a day. There are times when you don't want to do it. There are times when you really do. But you just keep at it, no matter what. And that's something we all learn too. But my biggest enterprise was cucumbers. It's funny what you can get excited about. I'm thinking of the summer of the cucumbers. That was great. I think I was 14 by then, because Jim was driving. He had the 51 Buick, which he got after we got the 62 Galaxy. And we saw this ad in the paper, the Gedney Pickle Company, you could raise cucumbers. You buy the seed from them, you plant it, you harvest it, and you take the cucumbers to this town called Windmere, and you sell it to them at the end of the year. And Jim and my mom and I decided to do this together. And we had this piece of land right near our farmhouse. It was, I think, about an acre, maybe about the size of half of a square city block or something like that. It was pretty big because cucumbers are labor intensive. And for Jim and I to hoe the whole thing, which we had to do several times during the summer, took about 3 days. And the planting and the hoeing and later the picking, I found that really pleasant work. You're out there in a sort of vast expanse under the great sky, you know, in the dirt, with all the smells and the clouds, and your brother's there, and you're talking some of the time, and your mom's there some of the time, and, you know, dad comes in from the field, and he helps us out a little bit. And we were proud of our work, and the vines were really beautiful. They're really beautiful. And the little flowers that get on them and everything, it's just a nice place to be. And when harvest came, we started to pick. They supplied the bushel baskets. And every 2 days, we'd pick about 30 bushels of cucumbers. That's a lot of bending over. And Jim had this trailer, which was like the cut-off back half of a pickup that he had bought. And we would take these things to Windmere. So Jim, he got more money out of the deal because he had the car and the trailer and all. And he's always been able to outwork me and always will. Always will, no doubt about that. And it was a great success. We even had a neighbor who couldn't get his cucumbers harvested, and we helped him out. And it just went really well. And at the end of the year, my share of money from this was startlingly small. But it didn't matter. It doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. It was a really good project. It was a really good project. You know, sometimes a neighboring farmer would drive by and he'd see us out there because it was next to a road, and he'd stop and talk to us, you know, and thought, this is really cool, you know, what you guys are doing. All the adults I knew when I was a kid were farmers that I knew really kind of socially, and I think they valued their ability to work above just about anything else. You know, they never drew attention to it, but that's what they really valued. And I remember once years later, heard an adult kind of bragging about how he would avoid work in various ways, you know, by getting bigger machines or changing the way it's done or getting somebody else to do it for him or something like that. And I think he considered this a sign of cleverness. And I was a little shocked. You know, no one I was raised with would have ever talked that way. These were really hardworking people. So my first actual job where I got an actual paycheck was hoeing sugar beets. This is when I was 15. There were certain agricultural jobs you could do without being 16 yet. And we had moved to town into Wahpeton by this time. Sugar beets were kind of a new thing at this time. It was the first year they had them, and it's a very labor-intensive kind of thing to do. So I would ride my bike to this place in town and meet a bunch of people there, and they would load about 20 boys into the back of this truck, covered truck with a bench on each side, and they would haul us out to the field, you know, and we would hoe sugar beets out there. And it was pretty good. They said we'd be paid by the row, and that sounded pretty good. It was something like $1.25 a row. And I had this friend. I got to be really good friends with this guy. And one day, we just had the best day ever. We were so productive. We were working hard. We were talking. We were enjoying it. We feel like we outworked everyone that day, made really good money. We were really excited about the next day because we were going to do it again. And the next day, we started doing the same thing, and somehow it just wasn't working, and we got tired of it, and it wasn't fun today. And I think we ended up going back to the truck and sitting in the shade of the truck by 11 a.m. or something. And I remember just being very confused about that. How could that happen? It was going so well, and it just all fell apart. How can that happen? You know. And years later, I learned that focus is not always there. And it has something to do with being in the moment. It has something to do with being present with your work. And we actually have the ability to affect whether that focus and energy are there or not. It took me years to learn that. So it was easy at first. I was probably making about minimum wage, which was probably about $1.25 back then. Then they moved us to a field which hadn't really been cultivated or sprayed properly, and the weeds and the grass were so tall you sometimes had to try to find the sugar beet in there. So it was so sort of choked with weeds, it took forever to do a row, and I realized I was making about 30 cents an hour. So I did the rational thing. I quit. And 2 weeks later, the rest of the crew quit. I was ahead of the curve on that. Then the supervisor quit. So, as the saga continues, are you still with me? It's the last job I'm going to talk about here. So we moved to Iowa, a small town in Iowa, and I turned 16 and I got my first real job. And that was working at a nursery where they raised a lot of trees and other kinds of plants, a lot of clematis. They raised these things for resale. And there was a wide variety of tasks there. Hoeing, weeding, trimming the trees, digging the trees out of the ground, loading the trees into trucks. So I ended up working there 3 summers full-time, and then during my junior and senior year in high school, I would work there after school and on Saturdays. And I think I made minimum wage, which was $1.35, brought home about $40 a week, saved for college. And it was great. I got really strong throwing these trees around. I got to be outdoors. I worked with this group of guys who were a lot of fun, and we were always clowning around. And after work, at exactly 5 o'clock, we would jump into our cars and drive at a pretty fast clip up to West Lake Okoboji and jump in the lake. We could be in the lake by, I think, 5:10. And that was pretty cool. And I think this was probably the best job I ever had. I remember my buddy Al, he drove a Volkswagen Bug, and he said to me, "You know, I've been driving about 1.5 years and I've had 4 accidents. I don't understand it." I'm thinking, gee, Al, you must be a pretty unlucky guy. And then one day I rode with him. And we're going around this curve about 55 miles an hour, and he's like 3 feet from the bumper of the car right in front of him. I'm like, "Al, slow down." But yeah, so I would have fun a lot of the time with these guys, but also I worked alone quite a lot. And there were days when I would take a hoe or some clippers or something. I'd go out to the field, and I'd work out there for 8 hours, by myself, alone, all day. And I liked this. I liked the solitary work. I liked thinking. I liked to organize my thoughts to kind of make the time pass. One thing about repetitive work is you have to figure out how to pass the time. And I would think about aspects of my life sometimes in kind of a deliberate way, kind of escaping into thought, which is not really the Zen way, but it's a way to survive work. We've all done that. But also sometimes there would be this kind of quiet mulling over of a problem or a thought, kind of holding it without actively thinking about it, kind of being present with the problem. And then sometimes there would be no one thing on my mind at all. I'd be really aware of the trees and the dirt and the sun and the gentle activity, and thoughts would arise and fall, and they wouldn't stay very long. And I had a lot of time to do this. I didn't really see the value of this then, but looking back, I know it was going on. And I certainly didn't know anything about Zen yet, but I know that that was kind of a shikantaza, kind of like just sitting, just being present. And I didn't have much of an inkling about spirituality at that time. I didn't think about it very much. But it happened that one of the guys on the crew was a Baha'i, and he sort of taught me about that faith, and I was not ready to commit to that faith, but I observed him, and I noticed his sort of gentle manner, his deliberate way of working, how much he seemed to enjoy this quiet work in the fields. And sometimes he'd bring a little scripture with him, and he'd read a little bit, and he'd go back to hoeing, you know, and then he'd read just a little bit. And this guy, I'm still friends with this guy, but that really inspired me, and I thought, there's something there. There's something there. I'd like to try that kind of life sometime. And there was this one day I was working at the nursery, and I must have been building something, because I can remember being at the scrap lumber pile looking for wood and going there repeatedly to find just the right kind of board. And what I do remember is this kind of profound feeling that came over me that day. And I think it kind of started with me pretending that every action I took had some profound importance. So I gave it a lot of attention, and somehow that pretending became real. And every action I took seemed to have this profound importance. It's kind of a sense of time stopping, you could say. And it was so distinct, and it was new to me. And it's so hard to describe. It's something about doing one thing and then doing another thing. It's something about I can pick up this board right here, and for whatever purpose, and I can deal with that purpose, put it down. I can pick up another board. It's a separate thing. There's no trace. There's no trace of that first action in this present action. There's no prior thing. There's no future thing. And I recognized that this was something new and beautiful. And now I know what that was. That was being alive. That was being awake. That's what we do in Zen. I gave myself. That's the thing. I gave myself. It was pure giving. It was the beginning of unlearning how to work, how to let go of all of those little stratagems, like pursuing your thinking in an organized way or escaping into a fantasy or something like that, that you learned along the way. You learn these things out of necessity. It's letting go of those things and somehow just being present with the work. And I learned more about that as time passed. And years later, all of this began to make some sense. And I think about these things. I think back to my enterprise of selling the greeting cards, and I see how overwhelmed I was by desire. You know, I felt I was kind of deprived, and I wanted this thing so badly, you know. And I suffered as a result. I think about how I learned to enjoy the process of working with the chickens and the cucumbers and pulling weeds in the fields, things like that. I learned it could feel really good to work. I learned the hard way with the chickens that you have to do the work even when it doesn't feel good. You just have to do it. And there was that confusing thing about how One day it was all so good in the sugar beet field, and the next day it all just fell apart. What was that? That has to do with expectations and attachment. That first day went so well because we really were in the moment. We were just giving and not looking for reward. We were just doing the work with some energy. And then we began to see how good that felt, and attachment came in, and we were looking for results. And that's why it all fell apart on the second day. We weren't in the moment anymore. We were wanting it to be like the previous day instead of letting it be what it was. So finally, there is just the doing. And the thing about that day at the lumber pile is that was real freedom. And the thing about working in the fields and spending that time not really thinking about anything but just being, that was like shikantaza. That was like meditation. Just working is like just sitting. And maybe those hours when, at least part of the time, I was just being there, just pulling the weeds, just doing the thing, just hoeing, that somehow led to that opening at the lumber pile. You know, it led to the opening. You have to put in your time. And the key is giving. The key is giving. The key is a radically different view of life. And I would like to read you one of my favorite passages, which I come back to again and again. Chapter 1, the beginning of chapter 1 from The Wisdom of No Escape by Pema Chodron. She says, "There's a common misunderstanding among all the human beings who have ever been born on the earth that the best way to live is to try to avoid pain and just get comfortable. You can see this even in insects and animals and birds. All of us are the same. A much more interesting, kind, adventurous, and joyful approach to life is to begin to develop our curiosity, not caring whether the object of our inquisitiveness is bitter or sweet. To lead a life that goes beyond pettiness and prejudice and always wanting to make sure that everything turns out on our own terms, to lead a more passionate, full, and delightful life than that, we must realize that we can endure a lot of pain and pleasure for the sake of finding out who we are and what this world is, how we tick and how our world ticks, how the whole thing just is. If we're committed to comfort at any cost, as soon as we come up against the least edge of pain, we're going to run. We'll never know what's beyond that particular barrier or wall or fearful thing." So this is our way. This is the way of Buddhism, and it's a radically different view. You can learn to do it. It's the way of freedom. And working is both an expression of this way and a means to learn it. In your work, you can let go of your desire. In your work, you can let go of your desire. And in the end, I equate work with love. Because of the giving nature of it, of bringing your full attention to the task at hand without expectation of reward or pleasure. With this attitude, you really do take care of things. You love the vines when you snap off the cucumber. You love the creatures you're charged with caring for. You love the people you're working with, the people you're working for. You love the end of the day when you jump in the lake. You love the morning when the ground is wet and everything is fresh. You love the parking lot and the cubicle. You love the city bus that takes you to work. And what a joy to be able to encounter the world in this way. Each moment, all you need to do is give yourself each moment. There are no future moments. It's just this one. All you got to do is give yourself in this one. In each moment, you can save all beings. You don't have to wait. You do the work of the moment, nothing else. You can save all beings in this very moment. So, that's what I have to say. Thanks for listening. And does anyone have a comment or a question? Or a brief story?
I'm curious. curious, that year that you didn't make much money, how much did you make? Do you remember?
I think I made $30 for an entire summer's work, which even then wasn't much money. But I was a little disappointed, but that's how it goes. Yes.
Thank you for that talk. That was a great subject, work. I often say that work gets in the way of my spiritual practice.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite interesting to look at it in a way of being a gate.
Yes.
And my question, so you talked about kind of physical work and work outside and being in the moment. I wonder if you think kind of the work that we do now, or the work that I do anyway, is more kind of intellectual and
yes.
people,
mm-hmm.
not so physical and outside. And I wonder if you could speak to that shift of nature.
Yes.
Of work.
That is a very good question. And I work on a computer now, and I do a lot of left brain activity. And so it is interesting. And my answer is, you can do it this way, the way I've been talking about, the way it was at the lumber pile. But I think it's harder. It's harder. But the basic approach to being really mindful at work and giving yourself moment to moment, it's the same approach I learned here. I think it's easier to learn while sweeping or pulling weeds or vacuuming or washing the dishes because you have fewer distractions. But I really believe you can bring that same kind of focus to even solving an intellectual problem. You know, it's hard to kind of take the self out of it and take out our needs and desires and things when we're doing that. But you can do it. You can do it. So it's kind of like you start with the simple things. That's why here in the Zendo, between sittings, we will do walking meditation. Okay? That's like the simplest activity. It's virtually meditation, but you're taking steps. You're doing something. And we have other things we do. We do chanting. We do ritual. Those things can kind of be a bridge from meditation to acting in the world, you know, and then you take that out into the world and you start with the simple things and you keep at it. Even with those complex things, you can do it. Yes?
Number one, I really enjoyed the talk. It kind of brought me back to the first time I came to the U.S., which was 1980.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to college in Washington State, and I came to the U.S. In April, and school started, you know, in the fall by that time, so the whole family took care of me. They had four boys. They all did the weeding at the wheat farm.
Ah.
And so I joined in. Of course, I was supposed to work because I was a student.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't allow me. So I worked, and the guy gave me money as a present.
I see.
I actually had a lot of fun doing that, so it kind of brought me back that way.
Uh-huh.
Number two, you know, maybe something related to what you mentioned. You know, when we did that second conference, you know, I always kind of tried to do theater.
Right.
Volunteer work.
Mm-hmm.
Just repetitive work.
Yeah.
I always kind of, you know, I played an engineer before. I used to work with Reed, right? Nasal strip. And problem solving is what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how we did it, you know, we filled it out the bag, and then the other side, they're filling it. And there's some gap, you know, and I mean, one path is getting faster than the other.
Yeah. So you're thinking about ways to improve the system.
Yeah. I always kind of go like, okay, they're getting behind, maybe I'll move in there.
Yeah.
There's always ways to kind of improve the process. And I'm doing a consulting work now, and luckily or unluckily, the client of mine, and they have a lot of not so smart people. I ask somebody to do something, and they only look at, okay, this is what I have to do. They don't really beyond.
Right.
And what would this actually bring to you? So mm-hmm. I always kind of think about, when I go to the office once a week, I think of like, okay, how can I explain to them better so they'll actually do the work the way I want them to do that?
Right.
Can you get the list? there, a list, and they don't look beyond it. They go, you know, like, okay, I want a little more than that.
Yeah.
But, there, you know, it's always kind of like, how do I improve that?
Right. And there's
a
definitely, there's a place for that, thinking about, while you're working, thinking about how to improve the process. There's also a place for doing kind of work that doesn't really give you choice, because I think that's kind of helpful to keep the mind out of it, you know.
Yeah.
Both kinds of things are useful. Yeah, yeah. You need to keep them in balance. Thank you. Yes?
I'm thinking that a lot of what you're talking about is what talk about flow.
I think so. I'm not familiar with that person, but I'm familiar with the concept of flow. Yeah, okay. Oh, I think so very much, very much. I've thought about how I remember, you know, taking a bike ride and afterwards kind of realizing I was so kind of into what I was doing that I kind of disappeared. And it's only afterwards you kind of realize how pleasant that was. And I think of that as flow. And the kind of thing I'm talking about is really, must be very similar to that. You know, kind of your own thoughts, concerns, and needs are simply not there. There is no separation between you and the activity. Mm-hmm. Yes?
When you're in a work situation where it's stressful and frustrating, how do you know when to stay in that situation and change your attitude and make it work? And how do you know when you need to remove yourself from that situation and find a better fit? Sometimes you're it's like in an unhealthy situation.
Mm-hmm.
And staying is not the right choice.
Mm-hmm.
But it's
hard to say, hard to give a general answer. But I think if it's damaging you, you really need to seriously look at it, and you have to think of the damage of staying versus the damage, sort of the risk of leaving, and weigh those, I think. That's about all I can say.
Stay in a situation and change your attitude or approach.
Yeah, change your attitude. That is interesting, because it's kind of the question of... Okay, so in Zen, we teach about sort of accepting what is, kind of going with the flow, not trying to impose your needs on the world, and just, you know, letting it be. And that's great up to a point, but it does have to be up to a point, because you can't accept things that are going to be harming you in an unjust way. You know, you simply can't do that. It's our responsibility to ourselves and to others to sort of stand up and say, I'm not doing that. So it's something about identifying that point, I think, of the difference between those two things. I mean, is this something that I can change, that I can accept without too much harm to myself? Can I possibly do some good here? Can I learn something by staying in this difficult situation? Is something positive going to come out of it? Or if I stay in it, am I going to sort of enable someone else's bad behavior and bring more, you know, sort of pain and difficulty into the world? For me, it's always a question is, you know, which choice is best for all beings? You know, and all beings, of course, includes you, the person in the situation. That seem helpful?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a tough issue to deal with. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, one more comment.
I've actually run into that a bunch with work, and what I kind of decided was that if it was my faults getting me into trouble, then I should stay and work on my faults. And if it was my virtues getting me into trouble, then I should get out. You know, my last job where I was very unhappy, the stuff that made me a very good employee elsewhere was what was causing me problems. You know?
Yeah.
So it's like to be... I kind of roll my eyes at the being your best self stuff, but that's actually what it is. You know, if your virtues are the things getting you into trouble, then that's not the plan for you. But if your faults are getting you into trouble, you're going to bring them wherever you go.
That's pretty good.
I quit a lot of jobs.
All right. Well, how about We have some announcements. Thank you, everyone.